We're talking about, okay, all right. Hopefully we'll be able to finish up Perpetual Peace and start talking a little bit about Hobsbawm's essay, Barbarism, the User's Guide. One of the interesting things about that piece by Hobsbawm, I included it in the set of readings because of its bleakness. Hobsbawm is a British historian who has written a number of books that have had quite an impact, but probably none has had the impact that his History of the 20th Century has. His History of the 20th Century is called The Age of Extremes, and he actually subtitles it A History of the Short 20th Century. He claims that the 20th century as an historically meaningful unit extended from 1917 to 1989. Now, in other words, he's making the point that centuries as units of historical meaning are not necessarily, they don't necessarily begin with the year one and end in the year 99.
So the other 27 years of the other centuries.
Yeah, well, I don't know what he does with those other years. That's a good question. But why 1917 to 1989? What happened in 1917? Actually, I'm wrong about that. It's not 1917. It's 1914 to 1989.
Started World War.
Yeah.
The end of the Cold War.
And, well, how did the Cold War end?
The fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, exactly. The fall of the Berlin Wall. 1914 was the year that the First World War broke out. And 1989 was the year that the East Bloc nations, shy of the Soviet Union, the dependent nations, you know, Poland.
So the first 13 years of that, not the second, the first 13 years of the 1900s is actually the 19th century? Or is that like,
I know you're pushing this. You have to ask Hobsbawm that question. Be careful, because he's in his late 80s, and you don't want to be responsible for killing him.
I'll stay.
Ask that question before. Yeah, Eric Hobsbawm, eminent British historian, all sorts of books to his credit, killed by Sean.
I won't touch that.
Okay. In any event, his claim is that something very significant happens in 1914, and something just as significant comes to an end in 1989. I'm not going to say a lot about Hobsbawm right now because I do want to finish up our discussion with Kant, but just let's focus just a little bit on World War One. We talked about this a bit before, in the 1914 year, because the advent of the First World War really changes things dramatically, you know, both in Europe and globally. Hobsbawm makes the point in his article that the 19th century was a century of relative progress. And I remember Kant dies in the early years of the 19th century. He's really an 18th century figure. And Perpetual Peace is written for the latter part of the 18th century. And Kant is an adherent of the Enlightenment. So remember, he actually writes an essay called What is Enlightenment? And he tells us that enlightenment is daring to use one's own reason. Remember, you know, Kant associates himself with the historical movement that, and the cultural movement that also had strong roots in France and in Scotland and in the United States, and which claimed, in essence, that society could be remade on a rational foundation. And if you think about it, the drafting of the U.S. Constitution represents such a project. It's an attempt by Enlightenment intellectuals, more or less, the political leaders of the early American Republic, to sit down and lay out a political structure that makes sense and that is able to take advantage of people's capacity for self-governance. At least that's the propaganda that surrounded the Constitution. Whether it's exactly the reality of it or not is another issue. But Kant thought that we were at a turning point, a turning point in which reason could be applied to the reform of social institutions, just as it could be applied to the mastery of the natural world. But of course, you remember, Kant saw a major problem. namely that enlightened nations were capable of arming themselves to the teeth, and so given technological advance. And not only enlightened nations, but any nation was able to acquire what we would now call weapons of mass destruction. And Kant looked into the future and saw this. And in his own age, by the way, he was also beginning to see the beginnings of the application of scientific technology to warfare. Explosive weapons, in particular, are emerging on the battlefields of Europe during the time that Kant is alive. And so he says, the only way that we can ensure that enlightened progress continues is by putting an end to war. Because war is a kind of, as Kennedy said about nuclear war, it's a sort of Damocles that hangs over people's heads. No matter how much progress we make, we're always liable to wind up in the mass grave. All of it could come to naught, given the advance of destructive weaponry and given the widespread practice of war. So we have to put an end to war. But remember, Kant tells us that putting an end to war is not something for a single generation to accomplish. It's something that has to unfold over the course of many generations. Every generation, he says, needs to make its own contribution, otherwise we'll never get to the final goal. But he doesn't expect perpetual peace to be achievable within his lifetime, or even within the lifetime of the next several generations. What he would count as evidence of progress, though, is an advance in that direction. Now, Hobsbawm doesn't refer to Kant, but he does refer to the 19th century as what I would call essentially a Kantian century. He makes the point that, at least among European powers, wars became infrequent. And not only did they become infrequent, in part because diplomatic procedures were developed to prevent the outbreak of war, but not only was that the case, but when war did break out, it tended to be shorter-lived and more mild in its effects than the wars of the 18th century. Now, of course, there are great exceptions to this. The American Civil War is an exception. But the American Civil War is not really a part of the European sphere, which is what Kant was himself immersed in. Still, nonetheless, civil wars are the bloodiest, most violent, and most destructive of all wars. At least there's an argument that can be made for that. And the American Civil War was an exception. Certainly, the destruction of Native Americans was bloody. And Kant, in Perpetual Peace, actually has kind of ringing denunciation of that. Also of the European trade in African slaves. Also of Europe's penetration and colonization of Asia. Kant is fairly far-looking in those respects. Nonetheless, Hobsbawm tells us, the 19th century saw the development of limited war, war that was limited by, for example, the Geneva Convention, which laid down standards for the treatment of civilians, standards for the treatment of captured soldiers, essentially by recognizing that both categories of individual possess rights in the Kantian sense that act as barriers to what nations can legitimately do to them. An unarmed civilian is not a legitimate target in war, and neither is a soldier once he has surrendered, according to the Geneva Accords. When a soldier has surrendered, he can be imprisoned, obviously, because your army, your nation has a stake in preventing him from rejoining his army. But once he's in prison, he must be given essentially the same treatment in terms of food and access to exercise and access to reading materials and so forth that the soldiers in your own army are given. And the Geneva Convention was just one of many agreements that were struck during the 19th century that began to limit and, to some extent, humanize the practice of war. So Kant, and I could say something else too, not only was that the case, But another major element of Kant's program, which we'll take a look at in a second in more detail, namely the spread of republics across the face of the earth, also gathered steam in the 19th century and the early years of the 20th century. And to the point where now there's hardly a monarchy left. And the monarchies that are left are more cosmetic than anything else. Now, the British queen, all this pomp and circumstance. And of course, she's a very wealthy person, and has a tremendous amount of wealth tied up in the royal family in England. But who gives a damn about her? She has no power. She's a figurehead, as are most monarchs. England is essentially a republic in all but name. And so the republican form has spread across the planet, as Kant thought that it would, and the practice of warfare in the 19th century became more mild and more hemmed in by things like the Geneva Convention. And then in 1914, cataclysm. It was unexpected. The diplomats of Europe, the governments of Europe, the government of the United States, expected a continuation of what the previous century had represented. But what they got was the bloodiest conflagration in history up to that point. How did the war start, by the way? Yeah.
Ferdinand was the king of Austria-Hungary.
The Austro-Hungarian Empire, yeah, Archduke Ferdinand. There were some old, ancient, quasi-imperial formations in play during that period of time. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was one of them. The Ottoman Empire was another. Essentially, the Russian Empire was a third. The Tsar was interpreted as sort of an emperor. And the Archduke of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was assassinated by a Serbian nationalist. And this brought into play a series of reactions which activated alliances between different parties. And so, very shortly after the assassination, people began to mobilize in the streets all over Europe, clamoring for war. By the way, it doesn't look like in this case it was governments that were pushing their populations into war, although there was some of that. It seems, if you look at the historical footage of the period, maybe I'm getting it wrong, I don't know. I'm not a professional historian. Maybe I'm getting it wrong, but if you look at the historical footage of the period, what you see is tens of thousands of people pouring into the streets, demanding that their governments go to war. And the crowds were enormous. And not only were the crowds enormous, but they were by no means only crowds of the conservative right wing. The German Social Democratic Party, which was the biggest left-wing party in the world at that point. It was so huge that the German Social Democrats were called a state within a state. They had their own newspapers, their own summer camps, their own cultural institutions, in addition to a political party that controlled the German parliament. They enlisted on behalf of the war. And so there was an almost universal upswell of popular sentiment to go to war. There was a mass mobilization in the streets, and that was followed by a mass mobilization of conscript armies. Wherever you went, the draft was implemented, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of men were brought under arms. Not only that, but the men who were under arms were supplied by armaments with from the new industrial capacity that had been building up for about the past 100 years. So the First World War involved the mobilization of massive numbers of people, armed to the teeth by industry. And we'll go into the details of this a little bit later. But the upshot of it was, by the time the war was over, there were 10 million dead. Now, that's 10 million dead. We're not even considering the number of people the number of casualties who survived. People who were unable to walk, men who, there are horrific photos of veterans of World War I in the interwar period essentially without faces. Parts of their faces blown off. You know, the level of suffering, both on the part of the military and the civilian population, was unprecedented. And so what seemed to happen in 1914 was the end of the progressivist hopes of the 19th century and the end of the Kantian dream. Well, of course, that's not quite true, because after the First World War was concluded, the League of Nations was formed. The League of Nations was the first attempt to implement Kant's program for an institutional structure that could put an end to war. That, of course, came to an end with the outbreak of the Second World War, which was even more massively destructive, by a factor of 10, you know, not 10 million dead, but 100 million dead. But that was then followed by the creation of the United Nations as a second attempt to institutionalize a Kantian conception of a world without war. Let's take a look at perpetual peace itself. Let's go back to the document and see exactly what Kant tells us there. You know, remember, the general argument that he gives is that because of categorical imperative, because the essence of morality is the demand that we treat one another as persons rather than things, and because war is massively destructive of human life, of the life of persons, we all have an obligation to end it, provided that it's possible to do so. Kant says it is possible to do so. And how can we substantiate that? We can substantiate that by referring to the fact that it has already occurred innumerable times. Now, you remember that Kant is a social contract theorist, as most of the great modern political theorists are. You know, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, Kant were all social contract theorists. And their conception about the origins of government and law all involved the transition from what they call the state of nature, which, as Hobbes said, is a state of war, of each against everyone else, to a state of civil peace, a state in which disputes between people are resolved peacefully through legal and judicial mechanisms. Now, Kant grants the conservative argument. He grants conservatives the view that people are dangerous, that they tend to be aggressive, that they tend to be self-centered, and so forth. Traditional pacifists generally try to take conservatives on that very point. They argue that human nature is pacific, that it's gentle, that what warps it is bad social institutions, that given the correct social institutions, people are quite capable of living in harmony with one another. But Kant concedes the conservative point, you know. He says, yes, it's true. People are aggressive. They are self-centered. And yet, it is still possible to put an end to war. It has happened innumerable times. It has happened whenever a people has established a government within the confines of a single nation. Because that establishment of a government means that people who are aggressive and who are self-centered have recognized that their self-interest lies in creating a state of peace. You know, in a state in which everyone is aggressive, violently aggressive to everyone else, in which there is no public authority to adjudicate disputes or to maintain the peace, we are all miserable. The most self-centered, an aggressive person in the state of nature, as Hobbes says, is as much in danger of losing his life as anyone else. And the biggest son of a bitch on the block still has to sleep at night. And it's very easy, no laws to prevent it, no police to catch you, no judiciary to punish you. It's very easy if you're the 90-pound weakling to sneak up to the biggest son of a bitch while he's asleep and plunge a knife into him. No one is secure in the state of nature. And therefore, everyone, remember, the argument goes, has a rational self-interest in making the transition from the state of nature to the state of civil peace. And they do that by creating a government which is enabled to enforce the rule of law through a monopoly of the means of force. Now, Kant says, if it can be done domestically, it can be done internationally. You see, the argument against the practicality of peace, Kant says, goes out the window when we recognize that we have achieved peace innumerable numbers of times across the planet on the level of the nation state, on the level of domestic society. We create a state of peace by adopting institutions that pass laws and enforce laws domestically. But then the state of war continues among nations. It no longer obtains among citizens, fellow citizens within a nation. You and I are no longer in a state of war. But since there is no international law, since there is no international political institution to solve disputes between nations, nation states now have the status that individuals used to have in the state of nature. In other words, we are all potentially in a condition of war in relation to one another. If China has a dispute with Korea, there is no international legal system to adjudicate that dispute. There is no way of preventing the outbreak of war if it's going to occur. The only way that China and Korea can ultimately pursue their interests in the last analysis is through violent conflict. And so even though the state of nature has been abolished domestically, it continues internationally. So Kant says, what I've shown by this is that, first of all, by reference to the development of peace domestically, I've shown that war can be abolished, even given human nature, even given people's proclivities to aggression and self-centeredness. And I've also shown that it needs to be abolished internationally in order for progress to be secured, the possibility of progress to be secured. Now the question is how to do it. Now that's the burden of the document Perpetual Peace. Now, you remember I said last time that Perpetual Peace is divided into two segments. The first part is what Kant calls the preliminary articles of Perpetual Peace, and the second part is what he calls the definitive articles of Perpetual Peace. The preliminary articles are steps that he believes could have been taken by his own generation to move in the direction of abolishing war. Now, remember, Kant doesn't think that a single generation can do the whole job. Putting an end to war is a massive project that's going to require the application of people over a very long period of time. But if each generation does not make its own contribution to that project, then it will never be achieved. Every generation is obliged morally by the categorical imperative, given the fact that it's possible to put an end to war, to do what it can to move in that direction, even if it's unable to complete the journey itself. So the preliminary articles, there are six of them, the preliminary articles are the steps that Kant's own generation, Kant believes, could have taken, could be taken, in order to put an end to war. The first preliminary article is that treaties of peace be genuine in character. Treaties of peace be genuine in character. Now, what does he mean by this? What's a genuine treaty of peace and what's a false treaty of peace?
I'd say, like, a genuine treaty of peace is when both parties come into it on their own accord. Not necessarily in back of the corner forced to agree that they'll stop fighting.
And what's the significance of the fact that both parties come into it?
Well, because if you force someone to sign a treaty, then they're always going to have like a bitter hostility against you. It's kind of like know, when you were a kid and you were 40, you take something with your sister or something, and you're forced, like, give it back. You always put it back in line, you want it back.
Right.
And so even if you come in saying you're going to stop the hostilities, there's always that desire that you want to be able to have your revenge.
Yeah. Yeah, what Kant is worried about is that peace treaties will be treaties in name only. In other words, there will be temporary secessions of hostilities that don't put an end to the causes of war between two nations, but that simply postpone the reinitiation of conflict.
That's what happened in World War I with Germany.
How? Explain.
Germany after World War I was, they made them sign a treaty in which they will not have a standing army, they'll pay all these reparations, all these things, and Germany, because it was defeated, had to sign it. But they just prepare for Second World War the whole time because they didn't really sign the contract out of will.
Yeah, do you know what the name of the treaty was?
Treaty of Versailles.
Yeah, it's the Treaty of Versailles, yeah. The Treaty of Versailles put an end to World War I. And it's a classic example of the kind of thing that Kant is talking about as a false treaty. And if you hold a gun to somebody's head and you say, look, you're going to sign this, and they sign it, you can't expect them to observe the conditions of the agreement when the gun is no longer at their head. And of course, in the case of Germany, and you're absolutely right, Walker, in the case of Germany, the Treaty of Versailles played a very significant role in laying the foundations for the Second World War. And not just the Second World War, but the Second World War by virtue of the rise of the Nazi Party to power in Germany, because one of the great weapons of Nazism as a political movement was its clear demand that Germany rearm itself. And of course, Germans saw this as a way of casting off national humiliation. Hitler was elected and then appointed chancellor. And, you know, the rest of the story didn't work out so well. But you know, the false Treaty of Versailles, Kant would say, the bogus treaty, the treaty that wasn't really a treaty, played its role in laying the foundations for World War II. So it seems completely obvious that Kant's right about this. You know, unless treaties are genuine, then they're not going to perform the role that they claim to, which is putting an end to the causes of war, at least in particular cases. There's only one problem here, and that is that we hardly even pay attention to the act of writing treaties anymore, engaging in treaties, making agreements. There was a peace treaty in Vietnam that ended the Vietnam War. Remember that. But was there a peace treaty in the first Gulf War? No. I mean, is there a peace treaty in Iraq now that ended the Iraq War?
Installation of a new government.
Yeah. Installation of a new government. The execution of the leader of the previous government. We're in a kind of different period now. You know, we'll have to think about that. To what extent does the practice of war bear much relation to what Kant was talking about in the 18th century? Well, in any event, the first of the principles of perpetual peace is that treaties be genuine. And you can see that this would be, at least in principle, realizable in a single generation. And at least in principle realizable even in Kant's generation. What it involves is a reform of diplomatic practice. It involves a different practice on the part of governments who engage in war when it comes to putting an end to conflicts. But it's not completely absurd that it should be possible to adopt it. Kant has several other such principles. Some of them seem rather antiquated, anachronistic. I mean, for example, Kant says, I forget whether it's the second or the third principle. Do you have the text in front of you? No, you just tell me. Is the second principle that that no dominion shall be acquired by inheritance and so forth? Yeah. Can you read that? Just read the top. The first.
No independent states, large or small, shall come under the dominion of another state by inheritance, exchange, purchase, or donation.
What the hell is he talking about? No dominion shall come under the influence of another through, say it again, please.
Through the dominion of another state by inheritance, exchange, purchase, or donation.
Inheritance, exchange, purchase, or donation. What is Kant talking about?
Sounds like a criticism to, like, royalty and getting married, for example, getting a country.
Eleanor of Aquitaine, when she married Henry the Fifth, was it? I guess it was Henry the Fifth. Eleanor, Henry the Third, I forget. I don't care. Some Henry. When Eleanor of Aquitaine married Henry, who was King of England, she brought with her the province of Aquitaine. And as a result of the marriage, the people of Aquitaine moved from being subjects of the King of France to being subjects of the King of England. That's the acquisition of a domain by inheritance, by dowry in this case. What's wrong with that?
You're giving away land, like that doesn't make any difference to the King of France. Like, it's not affecting his life at all. You're now changing the lives of three men to live in the province of Aquitaine.
Yeah. Kant makes the point that countries are not real estate. You know, it's a difficult concept to get because the notion of a country, the modern notion of a country, of a nation state, involves a territory.
Let me just sketch this out a little bit. I might have done this before. Bear with me if I'm repeating myself. If you take a look at France during the Middle Ages, or any of the major European countries during the Middle Ages, each was a patchwork quilt of different kinds of sovereignty. So you might have had here, as I said, an area directly under the rule of the king. And then here you might have had Aquitaine, which came to the king by virtue of the fact that he married Eleanor. And then over here you might have had a county which was formally under the control of the king, but really in which the count was more significant than the king himself politically. And here you may have had a papal state, a state ruled directly by the Pope, all within the boundaries of what was called France. That's not a nation state. You know, it's a country of some kind. It has a legal status, it has an international status, but it's not a nation state in the modern sense of the word. Nation states really don't, I'd say that the Dutch, as a result of their revolution against Spain, create the first modern nation state. But that's, people can debate that. Clearly, the American Republic and the French Republic, the results of the American Revolution and the French Revolution, are nation states. So what's a nation state? Here's France again, right? A nation state is a political unit which is unified territorially. In other words, there is no point within the territorial boundaries of France that is not subject to a single legitimate government. Instead of having a patchwork quilt of forms of political sovereignty, nation states are unified. They're unified under a single government, a single legitimate government, which rules over a contiguous territory. Everything within the limits of the nation state is ruled by the single central power. And there's a third aspect of nation statehood, which becomes significant. Kant will talk about it in his third definitive article of Perpetual Peace, and that is that people are citizens of a nation state primarily by the fact of having been born. I could draw you coming out of your mother's womb if I was a better artist. By virtue of the fact of having been born within the territorial boundaries of that nation state. Why are you an American citizen? I assume you are. Why are you an American citizen? Because you were born. Now, for people who want to become citizens, they go through a problem, who aren't born here. They go through a process which we call naturalization. They are naturalized. In other words, if we accept them as citizens, we decide to treat them as though they had been born within the territorial limits of the nation state. Citizenship in the nation state is determined by birth. By birth, real birth, or by honorary birth within the territorial boundaries. These are the units that Kant is discussing when he talks about the political realities of his current day. Now, for him, and one of the reasons why republics are valued by Kant is that a republic recognizes, but this is more or less true for any government, but a republic explicitly recognizes the fact that what binds people together in a nation state is their common consent. And the consent is the consent to be governed by the single legitimate government. Now, according to the social contract theory, people give their consent to be governed by a single central government, at least in Kant's version of social contract theory, because they want their liberties protected. In the state of nature, I'm free to do whatever I want, but that freedom is hollow because I could easily be snuffed out by anybody else pursuing similar freedom. When we create a government through an act of consent, a mutual consent to be governed, we guarantee, at least in the Kantian view, that certain central liberties are preserved. I'm no longer free to avenge myself against you if you do something negative to me. But I am free to go about my business without being threatened by you. That's what a central governing authority does. Given the fact that the people within the limits of a nation state have essentially consented to their government. As I said, in republics this becomes explicit. But I think Kant would argue it's true even in monarchies. And after all, why is it that the guy with the ermine and the pomp and circumstance and so forth is recognized by everybody as the king? You know, why doesn't everybody just turn their backs on him? And you know, there's a tribe in Central America. It's in South America, actually. I'm blanking on it right now. Pierre Clastres, who's a French anthropologist, writes about it. And the tribe has a practice every morning. Every morning the tribe gathers, and the chief of the tribe delivers a kind of state of the tribe address. You know, this is what's happening in the tribe, and if there's a conflict occurring, and if we just do what the ancestors did, everything will be okay, and so on. And the people in the tribe are bound by customary practice to turn their back on him when he speaks, so that the chief doesn't get the idea that he's somebody special. And this is a mechanism through which the tribe maintains egalitarian relations between people in the tribe. Well, in a monarchy, of course, everybody, in the European monarchy, everybody, you know, the king comes and everybody gets down on one knee, or there's the pomp and circumstance of recognizing the king. What does that recognition mean? Well, what it means, in effect, is that all of us have consented to be ruled by the king. Otherwise, we would do what the people in the tribe did. We turn our backs on him and pay no attention to him. So even in the case of a monarchy, according to Kant, people are essentially consenting to being ruled in the way that they are. Given the fact that consent binds these people together, and what this does is it creates a realm of what's called civil freedom. It is no longer simply a piece of property. Even though modern nations are have territorial integrity, they are more than pieces of property. They are places in which communities of people work out the conditions of their common liberty.
I have a question on this Kantian idea of social contract. Also, I think you'll apply to Hobbes' idea of contract. They speak of us having just having a contract where we theoretically agree, but it's not that there's any space in which, in a country, where people could just go and live, in, again, in the state of nature, where you didn't have to abide to that social contract. Therefore, you are not actually signing a contract. You're being obligated to live under it. It's not that we're going to make an island where all the people that don't want to do that do. Yeah. So, does Kant comment at all?
It's a tough problem in social contract theory. And have any of you signed a contract? Were you asked to sign the document? You did, right? You did when you entered the army. But and I suppose immigrants who are in the process of being naturalized sign a contract, in a sense. But the vast majority of people born in the United States are never asked to sign a contract. The philosopher who deals with this problem is John Locke. John Locke is the second of the great social contract theorists after Hobbes. And what Locke says, and it's philosophically unclear whether or not this works. Maybe it doesn't. What Locke says is that by virtue of living in a country and taking advantage of its laws, the protections of its laws, we all have in fact consented tacitly. Now, the category is tacit consent. Active consent is the process of actually signing our names to a document. Tacit consent is an implied consent that comes from the fact that we are all being advantaged by the laws of the nation that we live in. Go ahead.
Yeah, but my question goes beyond the tacit consent or the actual consent, because it's not that I is like, oh, I don't want the rules of the United States, I'm going to cross to Mexico. No, I immediately have to abide to the rules of Mexico. And then I go to Guatemala. There's no piece of territory where I'm not going to be able to have to tacitly consent to the contract. And I think that really presents a problem.
Okay.
In those terms.
I see. Go ahead.
Yeah, because you never have any piece of territory where you don't have to actually sign a contract. So you're certainly not signing
So in other words, what you're saying is you might have the right to emigrate if you can get the other nation to allow you in and naturalize you. You might have the right to emigrate, but all that means is that you have the right to select between different existing regimes to live under. What you don't have within that scenario is the actual ability to choose the nature of the social contract that you want to live under, or to choose to live under no social contract at all.
Especially that part, you have no choice to not live under a social contract at all.
Yeah. It's a problem. Is there a way out of this?
There's no hut somewhere in Ohio.
Say it again?
There's no hut somewhere in Ohio.
Ohio isn't a part of the U.S.?
I don't really.
I've been out there. I don't think it's a part of it. The Midwest. You know that famous cartoon in the New Yorker of a New Yorker's vision of the United States? It's got like the East Coast.
Oh.
And it's got New York itself, really. Yeah. Just a little bit of the East Coast, north and south of New York. Nothing in the center of the country. And then San Francisco. Yeah, that's it. It's basically my view of America.
Yeah, what's up there, anyways?
No, I know.
Mountains.
Maine? I mean, is that really a state? It's like Moose's, right? It's like
yeah,
Moose's.
Population 5.
Yeah, come on. Canada? Is that a country?
No. Canada is just a giant mountain. Probably not. They're above the USA.
They're insulting all the Canadians in the world. Be
split heads.
There's like 10 people that play hockey, and then nobody else does anything.
There's an American individualist anarchist. What the heck was his name? Is it Spencer? No, like Spooner. Lysander Spooner. And Lysander Spooner argued that the Constitution is null and void. And the reason why it's null and void is that it only held for the generation that signed it. Once that generation passes, unless a new constitution is created and signed, then there is no legitimate authority. You like that argument? So we suspend the Constitution every generation and redesign it.
Well, it's kind of like, wasn't it Thomas Jefferson who said that in order for our democracy to stay the way it was, we have to have a revolution every 20 years?
Every 20 years, yeah. That the tree of liberty needs to be watered by the blood of tyrants and patriots. I love that one. The tree of liberty needs to be watered by the blood of tyrants and patriots. These guys had a flair. Yeah, Jefferson did say that. And Jefferson was extremely worried about centralized government becoming too remote from people, and so what he wanted was a system of government that was supplemented by what he called ward republics, which were small-scale direct democracies, kind of like the Athenian democracy, where people would meet face-to-face and discuss, you know, what it is, what kinds of measures they wanted to take, and then take them. But of course, Jefferson also came from the tradition of New England town democracy, and sort of wanted to expand that. See, I think that what all the social contract theorists would say, and maybe this is false, but I think what they would say is, if you really knew what you were choosing when you choose the state of nature, you would never choose it. For Hobbes, the state of nature was England during the Civil War. See, I mean, Hobbes lived during the English Civil War when there was no single recognized authority, right? You know, there was the king and the king's army, and then Parliament and Parliament's army going at it against one another. Nobody knew, you know, who the genuine authority was, and the result, Hobbes would say, was bloodshed. You know, he saw, at least in his view, under the conditions of the English Civil War, the true state of nature between people, without political institutions, without recognized laws. And it's that condition that he's referring to when he says that the life of people in the state of nature is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Do you really want to live under a condition of perpetual civil war? That's the question that Hobbes would ask someone someone who claims that they would prefer living in the state of nature to the civil state. State with laws and the governance. You know, would you really like it if in Boston there were no courts and no police departments at all? What would the result be?
Chaos.
Would it be chaos? Would it be spontaneous order? Anarchists tend to argue that government is a major problem, that government is a cause of disorder and disharmony, and that if people are simply left to their own devices, they will tend to organize naturally in a cooperative way. Yeah.
I don't think that. I mean, some guy doesn't have any sense of morals, and you know, he'd be happy to kill somebody, and the only thing keeping him from killing somebody is the fact that he's going to go to prison or he's going to get executed. The government is going to give that guy a sense of orders and have some incentive not to do it. Might still do it, but at least that is something to say. There's disorder, and people who may not even regularly kill may be forced to do it. I mean, somebody's going to attack you, you have to be paranoid. You can expect you go to prison, or there's some type of law to keep so.
That it keeps, yeah, that acts as a disincentive for them. And even if it doesn't act as a disincentive, it gets certain people off the scene. Mm-hmm. Right?
If you didn't have that, I mean, you're just creating a power void, and any power void can be filled by someone who has either the strategy to do so or the actual power to do so.
That's a good point. So that it's not as though if all the current institutions were dismantled, what would follow is harmonious interaction between people. You have the Medellin cartel coming up and trying to do what it does, or the Irish mob reconstituting, or even my people, my mother's side, the Italians coming back into Boston. They've been gone for a long time.
Whatever
happened? They went to Providence, didn't they? The Italian mob, you don't even hear about them anymore. Oh well, things are not like they used to be. When neighborhoods were
still
really
happening. There's still some of the bands.
Yeah, I guess, but they're not, you know, they're mere shadows of their former selves. You've all seen The Departed?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, you know that the Nicholson character is supposed to be Whitey Bulger. You know that? You don't know that. Oh yeah, Whitey Bulger is on the 10 most wanted list. Has been on the FBI's 10 most wanted list for a long period of time. Pardon?
I think he's number one.
Is he number one now? It's possible. He was the brother. He is the brother of Billy Bulger, who was president of UMass for years. So unfortunately, you missed that opportunity. To have a president whose brother was on the 10 most wanted list. Billy himself.
How long has he been out of contract?
Pardon?
How long has he been in contract?
Not for quite a while.
He must have taught him when he was here.
What, where the brother was?
Yeah. No. When Billy Bulger was running. How long has it been since he stopped?
Oh, since he stopped.
Stopped running UMass.
Oh, well, he was pushed out by, what was the governor's name, the Republican governor? Not Salucci, Romney. He was pushed out by Romney. This is the story. The Departed is not, I mean, the parts of it that are really boring and silly. The fact that everybody gets killed in that, I can't stand. Everybody shoots everybody else. But there are parts of it that are also realistic. And the realistic part is that Whitey Bulger worked with the FBI. He had an FBI handler. Whitey Bulger was the premier Irish hood. Not Irish organization, Irish organized crime organization in Boston for a long period of time. And he was absolutely brutal. I mean, the kind of violence that he engaged in was violence above and beyond the call of necessity. It wasn't just violence that was that was geared toward keeping his opponents in check. You know, he murdered an ex-girlfriend in a horrible way, had her teeth pulled out before she was strangled by him. Just horrible stuff, you know, horrible violence. But in any event, he became very successful, and the way he became successful was that the FBI cultivated him as an informant. And what Whitey would do was he would inform on his competition. So the FBI, his Boston handler, would send a message to the Home Office in Washington, and the Boston branch of the FBI would then go into motion, and they would arrest and indict Bulger's competition. And then, of course, Bulger would move in and take over the business that the competition represented. And by working hand in glove with the FBI, he was able to build a real criminal empire. Billy Bulger was called before a Senate committee. And this was, I'm trying to think, this was about 8 years ago.
Yeah.
It wasn't, how old?
Yeah,
it was definitely after 2000. Yeah, it was definitely after 2000. Whitey Bulger was called before a Senate committee that was investigating the FBI's role in his brother's criminal empire. And so Billy was the president of UMass at the time. And Romney had been trying to get rid of him, because Billy had been the head of the Speaker of the Senate in Massachusetts. He was a powerful member of the old Irish political machine. And if you don't know this, there's been a battle in Boston for generations between the Yankees and the Irish. Right? The Irish's political base has been in the Democratic Party, and the Yankee political base has been largely in the Republican Party. And so this was a new kind of reemergence of that battle, that perennial political battle. So Congressional Committee called Billy to testify, and Billy took the fifth. And they asked him questions like, when was the last time you spoke with your brother? I declined to testify on the grounds that it may incriminate me, the Fifth Amendment. And he stuck to the Fifth Amendment. And as a result of that, Romney was able to force Billy Bulger out of the presidency. And so the argument was that the president of a major public university should not be pleading the fifth before a congressional committee. What do you think about that, by the way? Now that we're on the topic, yeah.
I think it would be the right thing to do, honestly.
But who did the right thing?
Abdul Bojo. I don't think you should have told him about his brother. Regardless of what his brother did.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people did say that. They felt that way during the period. In other words, that Billy Bulger was placing fidelity to his family above...
He could be afraid of his family, too.
No, I don't think that that was ever in question. Yeah, and I think it really was a matter of not wanting his brother to be caught. He actually said at the period of time, to the press, I think it was, he said, I hope I will never be helpful to anyone seeking to arrest my brother. But his brother was a mass murderer right now. And still on the loose. Nobody feels... You think that family really trumps this? You know? If your brother were a serial killer, would you think your obligation would be to testify against him or to... In other words, the fact that you don't testify against him is going to mean more people dead.
I mean, I would not testify myself either, but as far as like him being the president of a public university, you can't really, I think it's bad form to have someone in the government institution that you know may be in contact, especially if someone's on the FBI most wanted list. So they're working for the government, but they're not willing to help the government catch somebody who's been harassing the public. I just don't think it's coherent or it's in good form to have somebody in that position.
Yeah. There were some people who argued, I understand your point, it's an interesting point. I think it's basically the position that Romney took during that period of time. Although there was, like I said, they wanted him out anyway, and this was a good way to get him out. But there were some people who argued that Bulger's chief responsibility was to his fellow citizens in this case because of the extreme character of his brother's behavior. And one of the people who wrote into the papers to take that position was the brother, was it, or the sister? I forget, of the Unabomber. Remember the Unabomber? What the hell was he doing? I
think
he
got his.
Pardon me? Yeah. What exactly was he? What was he doing? He was sending mailbox, right? Yeah. That's right. He was sending mailbox. And people were being killed as a result of the mailbox. Well, one of his siblings, whether it was a brother or a sister, saw a sketch that the cops had made, or the feds had made, of the person they thought was the Unabomber, and they recognized their brother, and they realized that given what they knew about their brother, it was likely their brother, and they called the feds, and the Unabomber was caught, and stuff like that, and eventually. Is he in jail now? Is that right?
I think they executed him.
Did they execute him? Yeah. It's a tough choice to make. It's an indication of something that's pervasively true about moral life, is that often the option is not between acting morally and acting immorally. Often the option is between moral demands that pull in opposite directions. In other words, often the difficulties that we have acting and deciding are the result of moral conflicts rather than the simple failure to observe what we think is morally necessary.
Well, because for instance, like say, as the president here, say one of his students was at all harassed or influenced, maybe killed by the influence of his brother, who's he going to put ahead of them? The students he's supposed to be protecting and ensuring their safety and well-being?
Good point.
Or is he going to put his brother who's doing something wrong?
That's a very good point. It's not at all unreasonable to think that there were students here who were at least related to people who were harassed by his brother or assassinated by his brother. Yeah, because this is a commuter school, with a lot of residents going to school.
Something funny that I think about that, the Fifth Amendment, is just, you are saying, I'm not going to talk about it because that might get me in prison. And so you are, at a certain degree, you are admitting like certain part of complicity. They're going to judge you for it, but at the same time, I'm admitting a little bit of complicity in some kind of criminal activity. So
you think that by taking the Fifth, you're basically confessing?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
You're choosing a social judgment instead of a criminal judgment.
Yeah, that's right.
So he's pretty much saying, okay, I might get in prison if I open my mouth, so there's something fishy about what I'm doing. Like, I think that's just enough basis for him to get kicked out of my public office.
I see. Yeah. Although, Does it make sense to kick somebody out of public office for availing himself of the constitutional right? I mean, should there be a downside to availing yourself of the right?
That's
the
point.
Yeah. There are people who argued that during that period of time. Yeah, what good is a constitutional right if when you exercise it,
you're judged
negatively for doing so? But on the other hand, it seems hard to imagine that people wouldn't judge.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you can argue that not because it's in the Constitution or not because it's on the laws, it means that it's moral in nature. I mean, I think we have seen those.
Now, how do you mean that? Say it again. Okay. Not quite sure.
Not because something, it's part of the Constitution or an amendment to the Constitution, or because an action is penalized or not penalized by law, that doesn't make it a moral thing to be done. For example, apartheid.
Okay. Yes, right.
You know, it was legally allowed in South Africa. It doesn't make it moral.
No.
And we can see those kind of things throughout history.
No, that's true. But in the case of apartheid, what you have was a social system that was massively violated what Kant would call rights.
Oh, yeah, no. Right? But beyond the point, I'm just using...
No. But my point is that the difference is significant here. It's a relevant difference. In that, in the case of Billy Bulger, what you had was someone availing himself of a right that's guaranteed by the Constitution. In the case of apartheid, what you had was a social system denying the rights of the vast majority of the population. Kant would say that's morally significant. The difference between those two things is morally significant. Well, in any event, we come a long way around here. But the basic point that Kant is making when he prohibits the acquisition of the country through inheritance or through bargaining is that nations are not pieces of property. They're moral communities. They're communities that are bound together in a common life. And what's wrong, by the way, with aggressive war, although Kant says that as long as there's a state of nature between nation states, anything goes, in essence. Still, if you look at it from another perspective, from a higher perspective, what's wrong with aggressive war is that the nation that aggresses against another makes the citizens of the second nation choose. And the choice is now between the possibility of violent death and loss of freedom. Or I should say in a different way. The choice is now between freedom and the likelihood of violent death. That's really what an act of aggression and warfare does. It's either you mobilize and defend your country and therefore preserve your freedom but risk death, or you allow the other nation to come in, establish their dominion over you, in which case you lose your freedom. And that's at least the position that Kant himself takes. There's one, I'm not going to go through all six of the preliminary points, but there's one that I think is really interesting. And that is that, there are a couple that we should look at. One is that standing armies, Kant says, in time shall be totally abolished. Which number is that?
Number 3.
That's number 2. I'm not doing so badly. Standing armies in time shall be completely abolished. This is an interesting principle because to me it's always seemed like it belongs in the definitive principles rather than the preliminary ones. In other words, the definitive principles are the principles that would put an end to war once and for all. If you abolish standing armies, wouldn't that put an end to war once and for all?
No.
No, why not?
Because people stop their own armies if they have to. They have before.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you won't have like militias.
Yeah, exactly.
And then militias could enter into an aggressive posture as well as a defensive posture. Yeah, Kant says that standing armies are themselves incitements for war. Because one nation maintains a standing army and puts its national treasure into building up its armed forces. Well, the only way that other nations can protect themselves from the implicit threat is to build up their armed forces, to create, you know, their standing army and so forth. And so what you have here is everybody arming to the teeth and war becoming more and more destructive. Kant does say, and he also says another thing which I think is really interesting. He says that war, war, remember, is a violation of the categorical imperative. We've discussed this plenty of times. And we've also discussed the specific point that Kant makes. you would think that he would make the point here now that war violates the personhood of the citizens of the country that you war against, or that it violates the personhood of the soldiers of the country that you war against. But the point that he makes here is that war violates the personhood of your own soldiers. In other words, war is a denial, and not just war, but a standing army is a denial of the personhood of your own soldier. And the reason why is what? Why is it a, what sense is it a denial of the personhood of your own soldier to maintain a standing army? Yeah, you're turning individual people into simple means with an external end. You're turning them into killing machines, essentially. And by the way, the emphasis that Kant has here is not on the killing, it's on the machine part of it. You're turning them into machines. You're turning them into simple tools for the realization of external purposes. And that's a violation of the categorical imperative. Absolutely. There's one other principle of preliminary principle that I'd like to talk about, and then we can take a break. And that is that nations shall not interfere in the domestic affairs of other nations. Can you find that one? Is that six or
five?
That's
I think.
Five. Can you read that in its Kantian version?
No state shall by force interfere with the constitution or government of another state.
No state shall by force interfere with the constitution or government of another state. This is an absolute prohibition against intervention. But wait a minute. Is it defensible? Is it defensible? So for example, it would seem that to apply this principle to the 40s. Now it's not the case that the Western powers entered into the Second World War to save German Jewry from destruction. But would it have been morally correct for them to have refrained from intervention had they known about the extent of the final solution? In other words, apply Kant's principle to the final solution. There is a government in place that is committing genocide, in the process of committing genocide, over a major segment of its own population. Does Kant's non-intervention principle make sense in that context?
But I think that Kant will say that he doesn't want states to intervene, to say that League of Nations should be the one that is the decision of the League of Nations.
Well, except there is no League of Nations at this point because we're
exactly,
in a preliminary period.
Yeah, but at the after that period, I think once. No, yeah, no, I know. The question is towards, and that point of time.
But is he saying that the League of Nations shall not intervene, or is he saying that there shall be no intervention? That it's illegitimate to intervene in the affairs of another country. Can you read the rest of that? Kant gives his reasons.
Number five.
Yeah, if you can.
For what is there to authorize it to do so? The offense, perhaps, which a state gives to the subjects of another state, rather the example of the evil into which a state has fallen because of its lawlessness should serve as a warning. Moreover, the bad example which one free person affords another as a scandalum acceptum is not an infringement of his rights. But it would be quite different if a state, by internal rebellion, should fall into two parts, each of which pretended to be a separate state, making claim to the whole. To lend assistance to one of these cannot be considered interference in the constitution of the other state, for it is then in a state of anarchy.
Yeah, okay. Let's see if we can pick this apart. Kant says that one line of justification for intervention isn't going to work. And that is that the state that one intervenes in is a bad example for your own people. right? That's probably ever used as a rationale in the convention. Namely that, let's say that there is a state in which a government is overly tyrannical, or a state in which the government is being challenged by an internal movement or something like that. The line of justification for intervention in that situation would be that the continued development of that scenario would undermine political stability in your own country. And what Kant says is that that argument doesn't work. And it's more likely that the condition of the first country would serve as an object lesson to people. In other words, instead of actually affecting your nation, a condition like that in the second nation would act as a warning not to fall into that condition. It's a convoluted argument, and it doesn't seem to me that it's the rationale that most countries give when they intervene in the affairs of another country. But let's take a look at the exception that Kant gives. He says, in the case of civil war, where you have a nation that splits apart into two parties, and they're struggling violently for control of the entire country, then foreign intervention is permitted. It's okay to back one side in the civil war. Why is that?
Because it's no longer actual working government or state. It's now in a state of anarchy. So it's...
And I think Kant's assumption is like Hobbes, that there is nothing worse than a state of nature. There is nothing worse than a state of civil war. That, in essence, any order is better than the complete disorder of civil war, and the complete disorder of the war of each against all. Now, remember that Kant is writing in the 18th century, the 1700s. Now, Kant has not witnessed the final solution in Europe. Kant has not witnessed the genocide of the Armenians. Kant has not recognized genocidal wars, has not experienced genocidal wars in Africa and so forth. Kant is used to a kind of war that's much more limited than the wars and the genocides that we've become familiar with coming after the 20th century. So one of the big issues in current debates over international methods of putting an end to war is whatever authority is developed internationally, ought it to have the military capability to intervene in situations of genocide?
Yeah. In going off Kant's own writing, I would say that Kant would be okay with it, because later on he discusses basically the horrors that a despot government can bring about. And he even makes the statement that a despot government is all who are not quite all to decide basically the fate of those around them. And this is a contradiction to the general will with itself and with freedom. So I think he would even make the distinction that in a government kind of like with the Nazi Party, you have a government that not only decides the law, but carries out the execution of the law. Mm-hmm. And in that type of situation, it's a small minority who decides for everyone what happens, and that's a complete violation of freedom.
And similarly, when things get to the level of genocide, then the argument could very easily be made that a state of civil war would be preferable. Mm-hmm. Because at least there would be the possibility of defense. Yeah. Let's take a break, okay? Take a 10-minute break. We'll come back. Sign-in sheet. I forgot this thing went around. Oh, the exam. Yeah. Oh, I haven't handed those back, have I? Right. Hand some of them back. I did hand them back. Yeah. I'm sorry. What's your name again?
My first name is Ashton ABCIA.
Yeah. That was a good paper, if I remember.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is a good thing. Where are you? You know, I haven't gotten to the papers that I handed in last time. Oh. If you handed your paper in last week, you're going to have to wait one more week for it.
I handed it the day it was due.
You handed it in the day it was due.
Amy Lozano was my
Yeah, then you should be. You're here.
That's me.
That's you. And this is you. Now, for people who just get papers, you should recognize that you have a rewrite option. Okay, if you don't like your grade, you are able to rewrite the paper, and when you do, I will take the higher of the two grades. And you have until the last day of class to do it. Is this you?
Yourself? Yeah.
And?
I was supposed to do last week, but I didn't come to class.
Oh, okay. That's a good excuse.
Yeah. These ones are for Second Life. I told you I'd bring in hard copies.
Yeah, you know, I didn't recognize that. I mean, I knew that Greg Herman was in this class, but I just didn't respect that we're all in Second Life. How are you doing with the Second Life?
Doing well so far right now. I think the, especially the blog spots that you've been posting, those have been the most beneficial, because some of the reading like that, especially like Adorno's and stuff, I was a little
confused. That was tough stuff.
But then once I picked up on it with that,
the podcast.
The podcast, exactly. Yeah. And the discussions help too as well, so you get other people who might have got onto it a little better than
I. Have you spent any time in Second
Life? I've only spent a little time on it. I had a previous avatar before, and now I've just re-registered an account, so I'm going to be getting used to getting back on
that. I was I actually bumped into the director of distance learning today, and she asked me how this is going, and I said, well, I think the course is going well, but I don't have the sense that students are actually spending a lot of time in Second Life, which is understandable. I gave a course in Second Life, a Second Life course, a few years ago, and the way I did it was it was an independent study for 7 students, and we met each week as a class.
See, I think that would be where it might be beneficial.
Yeah,
like if it were almost like, well, not a distance learning class, but if we're actually in the university, and it was required to go on there, I think it'd be more of a
That's the difference. See, the asynchronous character, not all together at once. I have a lot of, you know, it's interesting. It's the first distance learning class that I've given, and I sometimes have trouble believing that there are other people out there, but I actually have students.
Yeah, that's what you mean.
So it's good that you're here.
Yes. No, I'm one there.
I'm supposed to be in my paper last week, but I didn't make it last week.
Oh.
You didn't email it to you, so I guess.
We should play dodgeball. Can we play dodgeball?
How awesome. Come again?
Yes.
Oh.
So
I should replace the accent.
Yeah, it's like the
I have a student from Jamaica. Did the British colonize?
Yes.
Yes, because it's definitely a British quality to your accent. Yeah.
I don't know. Okay, so.
Yes.
Well, I like my group, but as far as like my plan, is that for Class of AOL?
Well,
or that it's almost coming up, so do you think I'll be fine?
Let me see. Oh, I think. Are you in danger of? Certainly not in danger of flunking the class.
Oh, that's what we're asking.
Oh, no.
No?
No,
okay.
I don't want to be in danger of flunking
the class. Okay, so I'm like an AOB student in your class?
Pardon me?
I'm an AOB student in
your class. Well, if you write a decent final paper.
Oh, okay. And that's what, like 40%
or something? It's worth a lot, it's 60%.
So I gotta get like an A on that one.
No, you could be on that one. You could be for the course.
If I get an A on that one, I'll get a B on the course?
If you got a B for that one, you get a B on the course.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You missed a few classes, but...
Just two.
Yeah, that's all right. Don't miss any more.
I'm not. Am I a friend? I don't know what's up with her. The other girl?
Yeah. I think it would be foolish for you to do a pass-fail option.
Yeah, I'm not. I'd rather get the credits, but I'm not going to... Unless I'm dying or something, I won't miss.
I'm sorry?
You won't prove wrong.
You're right. You need to probe more deeply. It's a B. Probe more deeply.
Okay.
But you know what? I'm a terrible speller, so.
Professor,
is
there a sign-in
sheet today? No, I forgot. I'll send one around now. Okay, when people come back, and that way we'll catch all the early absentees. I like the title of this Essay, Greg. 1, 2, 3, put your heart on the floor.
I'm trying to think of something catchy.
Nice. Good.
Second title though is a riff on an actual movie, though, a documentary.
Let me see.
The fashion paper.
Before the music dies. Yeah.
It's
Since
2007 documentary, I want to say, or so.
And was it about?
It's about like kind of like Clear Channel, but all just about the whole entire musical industry. And
that's right.
Like how it's surviving and how it can still prosper even in a time of, you know, troublesome with all the corporations.
Yeah, it's it is a crisis. There's no doubt about it.
There's a lot of musicians fronting on it. Good, large name musicians, even just more of your kind of background. You know,
Yeah, and also the development of the new technologies.
Yeah, YouTube and everything like that, I was saying. Yeah. All the freedom of people speaking as well.
It's made it a lot easier for people to get this stuff out, and a lot harder for people to get paid for it.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's a programs like GarageBand have like black bands. People start their own GarageBand.
Right, yeah, exactly. I'm sorry.